You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.
Tony Duchesne here, and welcome to Drinks with Tony. My holiday screenplay outline workshop starts on December 22nd. You will work for 10 days, from story idea on day 1 to a completed, detailed 50-scene outline by day 10. You'll commit to working 2 to 4 hours a day. A lot of that time will be spent watching films, understanding structure, and creating your film story beats that are used in almost every feature film you've ever watched. Early bird discount is until November 10th. Go to drinkswithtony.com for the link to register. There you will also see the daily schedule as well as our online Zoom meeting schedule. If you have an idea and you haven't completed your outline for your film, now is the time. drinkswithtony.com to register. And if you don't have an idea, on day 1 we'll shape your idea during the workshop, and by day 10 you'll have that detailed outline. I've been teaching for a decade at UCLA Extension to students who've gone on to produce great work. Now I want to offer the skills during the holiday break where some of us writers get most of our work done. I want you to join all us writers who get more work done, who have not many family members to cook for. So join us. I've had the joy of seeing my screenplay become a feature film. It takes work and it's also so magical at the same time. So join me for the 10-day screenplay outline intensive workshop, December 22nd through January 2nd. Register and see the daily calendar at drinkswithtony.com. I'd love to work with you. And now, on with the show.
Hi, this is Darren Doyle, and you are listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Darren Doyle. He's the author of The Dark Will End the Dark. The Dark Will End the Dark short stories. Darren, how are you? And I'm very sorry for screwing that up.
Oh, that's okay. I'm doing well. Thank you. And thanks for having me.
Yeah. And this is a re-release of this book, right? It's a 10-year anniversary edition?
That's correct. Yeah. It's largely the same, but it's got a new cover. It's got a foreword by Chicago author Giano Cromley, and it has a new short story in it.
Well, see, here's my problem. Because I have a novel finished right now, and I'm querying agents, and I just got a very great rejection. You know, the good rejections where they're like, oh, this is good, but, you know. Anyway, When I get the next agent, I also have my first book, which came out 15 years ago, which the print run's, I think, done. Maybe there's maybe some on a shelf, but it needs a new cover because there's been a film made about it. It needs an afterword because I do feel like I needed to give it a bit of an afterword. And so, but I'm not shaking any trees yet. I'm waiting until there's an agent, until there's some leverage where they go, oh, wait, we got a bidding war with like all of the big four, you know, which happens all the time. And then from what I understand.
Yes. It's very common.
Yeah. Anyway. So it's pretty cool to get a re-release and to be able to put some extra work in there and get a new cover.
Yeah, it was really cool. This is the first time it's happened to me to have a second edition, and it was a lot of fun to revisit the stories. And it's a great opportunity to kind of, like, he wanted to reach a different audience. When this came out 10 years ago, Tortoise Books, this was probably the third book they did. And so they were very new. And fast forward 10 years, and they've got, I don't know, 50 titles. They've got international distribution. Things have been going really well. So I thought it was super cool of him to kind of let this reach a new audience.
Very cool. Yeah. And that's something that when I've seen my friends like be the first or second book on a publisher, and I'm kind of like shaking my head going, no, don't do that. You're the one that they're going to try to figure out what they do wrong with. So it
Yeah.
gets better later. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I want more and more publishers constantly, but it's just
Yeah. It
there
was.
is also kind of a red flag about it where it's just like,
Yeah.
oh.
I took it. I felt like I was taking a chance with them, and they were taking a chance with me. I had tried other publishers. This is not a, mass market book. It's very odd. It's dark. It's grotesque and weird. And and short story collections already are, almost never published by Big Four, like you said. So I tried a number of small presses and just not had any luck. He really got behind it, and the editor and owner Jerry Brennan, and I just got a real good vibe from him. He just seemed, I don't know, you can kind of get a sense from people, and he just seemed to have his stuff together and be a person of integrity, and I was right.
That is, it's so interesting going with the gut. And finding people with integrity and then clinging on to them because it's like that's when we really got to listen to our gut, and that it's when I haven't listened to my gut, it usually creates problems. When like intellectually it's just like, no, this intellectually it's go this way, and my gut's like go the opposite way. And if, oh, but the intellectual part looks really pretty. So then I go that way, and then we're not intellectual, but like the brain part is just like, wow, this makes a lot more sense. If you do this, this, and this. Then what do they call it? They don't call it intellectual. They call it it's another word
Logic.
for it. What's that?
Logic or I don't
Yes, exactly. That's great. Yes, the logic. Logic looks great. And then, but your gut goes, dude. And then if you don't go with the dude, it usually doesn't end up as a great outcome, from what I've learned, from what I've gathered.
I agree.
So, and you got a bunch of books out.
I do, yeah.
You've been writing for years. When did you start this game? What was your first published book?
My first published book was a novel called Revenge of the Teacher's Pet, a love story. And it was, yeah.
That get you canceled now. I teach at UCLA Extension. I just got a note about setting bound. Are you going to come to our seminar about setting boundaries with your students and creating safe spaces? I'm just like, no, I'm not. I'm so tired of these stupid lectures. But it just, we're in different times, man. What year did that come out?
That was 2009.
Oh,
So,
yeah. Back in the sexy years of teaching.
what's that? The
Back in the
sexy
sexy
years.
years of
That's
teaching.
right. Now that was, it's a reference to like this. There's two elementary school teachers who are kind of late in life, a 40-year-old and a 50-year-old. I wrote this thing when I was like 30, and that seemed wildly old to
Isn't
me.
it crazy? Is it yet? And then we get here, and then it's just like we just still feel like we're the 20 something, and you look in the mirror and you go, oh, why is my dad here?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, so that one, it's so it really, I've had a lot of success. It took me a while to get my first book published. Having started really writing seriously probably 1995, and so it didn't, I didn't get a book published till 2009. But then between 2009 and now, I've had seven books. So once it started happening, it kept happening. And I have an eighth one coming out in 2027.
Oh, no way. Then we're going to talk again. That'll be fun. What's is that a novel or is that short stories as well?
That's a novella.
Novella? Okay. And I have this one. I think you may have sent this to me.
Oh, yes, I
Yeah,
think I
that
did.
Let Gravity Seize the Dead.
Yes,
I
that's
like your titles, man.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't take credit for the dark one. The dark. Well, I can take credit for the title, but I didn't write the title. It's from a poem by who the heck is it? By Edward Arlington Robinson.
Oh yeah.
And so, yeah, I really struggled to find a title for the dark one in the dark. And I just, nothing was coming. And I brainstormed and I looked in the stories, tried to find something like Let Gravity Seize the Dead is a line from in the story.
Yeah.
But this one, man, I could not find anything. And I started looking up poetry about darkness. And there you go. I found it. I think it's a cool title because it sounds like a paradox, of course, the dark will end the dark. But
yeah,
it kind of makes sense to me, this idea that you kind of need something of what ails you to cure it.
Right. It's like a vaccine almost where you get a little piece of it in order for your body to learn how to push it away.
Yep, exactly.
Which I still got to get my flu shot. Thanks for reminding me. I got a colonoscopy coming up. Let's talk medical, right? Colonoscopy. And
that's
then,
fun.
But I better get my flu shot too. Yeah. I already did shingles though. I got shingles out of the way. I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, I had my flu and COVID 1 month ago. So
yeah. We might live. We just might live.
As long as they keep having the vaccines, yeah.
So you live in Michigan. We were talking, it's called Pleasant Mountain?
Mount Pleasant, yeah.
Mount Pleasant.
Pleasant Mountain's a cool name though, too.
yeah.
And of course, there's no mount here. There's no mountain. The legend is that it was named after a brothel downtown.
Oh, really?
Yes. I don't know if that's actually true or not, but
like from the 1800s kind of thing.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Yep. I just read a book set in Butte, Montana, by Kevin Berry. I think it's called "The Winter." The heart of winter, something like that. It was set in the 1850s. And it's just, I usually don't like those kind of stories. But I always think in my head, oh, it's just going to be another Western. Right. But it kind of just turns out to be cool and dark. And I'm just like, oh, wow. I gotta stop being, prejudiced against these things and just dive into them. And then after that I read Flannery O'Connor and I'm going, oh wait, I didn't know I like Southern Gothic books.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Oh, so yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I agree. When you we all have our biases, of course, but yeah, now and then I get pleasantly surprised by something I didn't think I was a fan of.
Yeah. And I feel like that's the lovely thing about just being a reader and a fan of novels, is there's always more. Even it may, you know, even if we're having a time where it could be kind of sleepy in the publishing world, it doesn't mean that there is a huge canon of hundreds of years to go back and dive into and find some gems, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's a great point.
I was reading I don't know why I found this guy, and this guy was a one-off. He wrote one book, and I think his name was Noel Clad. And for some odd reason, I go to, in order for me to find new books, I like get on Reddit, like stuff and Reddit literature and Goodreads. And I'm always trying to find the little diamond. And this book was good. It wasn't great. It was like, it was kind of a noir set in Los Angeles. It was good. But the thing that keeps sticking out was because the guy was cheating on his wife. He was on a business trip, and then he gets all wrapped up in all this stuff. But his wife at home kept talking about the price of coffee. It was written in the 1960s, and she just wouldn't shut up about the price of coffee, and it became like the ongoing thing. It's just like, what? Oh, is that the woman that's like, can't shut up about the price of coffee is going up. And I think that was kind of the metaphor for like, he was having a boring marriage. That's why he had tried to get out. He was like acting out, you know, he ends up losing them, his mistress and her, but, it was just like, yeah, she just couldn't shut up about the price of coffee.
That's great.
Yeah. So every time I'm wanting coffee, I'm like, she couldn't shut up about the price of coffee. It's just like stuck in my head.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh no, you had a thought. I saw you light up.
Talking about older stuff and kind of discovering stuff, and yeah, I agree with you. It's fun to find these. Like, have you ever heard of Erskine Caldwell?
No.
So he's like a Southern writer.
Okay.
Boy, he was like a huge bestseller back in, gosh, when was it? 40s maybe.
Uh-huh.
Some of his books were kind of scandalous, you know, like because of their racy content. And like Tobacco Road, I think, was a huge bestseller.
Okay.
And the boy, I'm forgetting this one that was about this boxer who's this fighter, professional fighter, or amateur fighter who gets in all kinds of trouble. That's a seedy book, man. But they're really good. They're definitely kind of potboilers, but they're well written and very southern, very rural. Yeah. So Erskine Caldwell, check him out.
Yeah, I'm gonna check him out. I just got into this guy about 5 years ago, Max Collins, who did the Quarry series. I don't know if you've heard of that. And yeah, it was actually a film. It was a TV show on Showtime, I think. And the only reason I watched it is because the guy who edited the film that I wrote like went off, and that was like his next gig. And I'm like, oh, I got to see what Doc did, what Doc was working on. And then I just got totally into the show. I totally forgot I was watching it. I was just going to watch one episode so I can go, hey, dude, good job. And then it was just like, boom, I was totally in. And I'm like, now I got to read the books. And the books are fun, too.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's fun finding those deep dives. What about classics for you? Like, have you dove into... Because here's what happened to me. I never went to college and I found reading late. So I'm always feeling like I'm trying to catch up. But now at this point, it's like, no, I've caught up for the most part. But I'm still like, I read Ulysses for the first time 3 years ago and it wasn't easy, but it was totally gratifying. And I can't wait to read it again because now I feel like I know how to read it, you know?
That's an amazing book. And that one was very influential to my first novel, weirdly, even though they're not like each other at all, but just the language in that is so inspiring. But yeah,
when did you read Ulysses? How old were you?
I was 30, maybe 29, something like that.
Good on you, man. I don't think I could have read it at that time and been I think I may have tried to read it. Someone told me, oh, you gotta read Ulysses, and I was just like, threw it against the wall, and I'm like, no, I'm out. And
so, you know, I don't claim to understand all of it, but I didn't worry about it too much. Actually, I take that back. I think I had a class. I think that's what it was. So that helps a lot. To have a teacher and conversations and stuff about sections. I forgot about that.
And I did that too. So it was during COVID. So there was this class in from the a library in Ireland, where you just had to pay like $15, and this guy like worked you through all the episodes, and then he had an hour lecture. He had a 20-minute. I'm going to set you up for the next three episodes, and then after that, 3 weeks later, there was an hour lecture on what we would just went through, and that brought me through the whole thing, and I'm so glad he did, because it just that book is just cuts right to the heart. I'm going, oh my God, I had no idea this would affect me this much. I was like, I was crying at the end. I'm like, who am I? What did I become?
Yes. But yeah, I don't know. I like a lot of the kind of standard authors, I suppose, like Philip Roth and Bernard Malamud, like these Jewish authors, Saul Bellow. But then, you know, if you're going into like horror or classic stuff, I love Shirley Jackson. She's like one of my favorites, and I've been touting her stories to my students for a long time now. And she really holds up, you know. She wrote in the 40s, 50s. So it's just, her book, We Have Always Lived in the Castle, is one of my favorite novels.
I'm writing that down.
Yeah, it's great. It's a very short novel. It's maybe 130 pages. It's a great example of the unreliable narrator.
Oh, fun.
Yeah.
That's a lot of fun. Oh, you said Shelley, and then that brings my brain to Mary Shelley. And yesterday, I saw the new Frankenstein movie, Guillermo del Toro directed. Yeah, I loved it. And I think I may have loved it more because he was there at the beginning to present it, and then he did question and answer after.
Oh,
And
wow.
when he presented it, he was saying that it was really important to him because it's the story of father and son and how his complicated relationship with his father, and then now he's a father, so he feels like he's already needing to apologize to his son, and that's how like it when he brought it to that context, I watched the movie probably in a different way than if I just passively watched the movie on
Yeah, that's a good
streaming.
point. Wow, that's cool. Yeah, I will have to check that out. That's a good thing about living in LA. You can go and see movies where the director's there.
There's upsides to stumbling over fentanyled out people on my block. When I'm like, man, it
You
must be
go.
nice not to pay rent and just be on fentanyl all day. I'm making wrong decisions here. I'm making wrong decisions.
Indeed.
But yeah, at the same time, the struggle it to struggle is a better way of life. To struggle with, struggle with the words, struggle
Yeah.
coming to the page every day.
True, true.
Yeah. Do you keep a schedule as a writer? Are you pretty,
I used to, but when I first started really being serious about it, I wrote 2 or 3 hours every night. I would write at night, and I did that for a good, gosh, almost probably 8, 10 years or something like that. Including when we had kids, and I could be up, and then when the kids woke up in the middle of the night, I could let my wife sleep, and so it worked out. But then I've stopped doing that a while back, and now it's so hard with my job. I'm teaching at Central Michigan University, and very hard to do any substantial writing during the school year. So the good thing is the summer breaks. So that's really when I do almost all of my writing now.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
If I was teaching full time, summer would just be where I would collapse. I'd just be like, put me in a box somewhere and give me Cheetos and Netflix. And
You can have Cheetos and write,
oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
No, it has changed. Like I like to take, like go places. There's like a rustic cabin in northern Michigan. It's way out in the woods. That very much inspired that Let Gravity Seize the Dead book, actually. And I've been going up there for at least a few days every summer, and there's no power, no running water, and I just write by hand, and man, I get a lot done there, and it's really nice.
Do you feel like you get a lot done because it gets to the root that you can just write without any power and just having some pen and paper?
Yeah. Some reason pen and paper to me just feels kind of freeing, even though I don't do it all the time. And in fact, I don't do it. Yeah, I mostly write on the laptop, but when I do pen and paper, it's like it doesn't feel permanent, and it's an illusion. But it like you write it down, and then you can go back to it and scribble stuff out, add stuff in the margins. It's like an object that you can play around with more. Whereas on a screen, it just everything you type feels like it's set in stone. Even though I revise stuff, but I think I just do better work, I think, when I start out with pen and paper.
I do too. I just have the yellow notepads in my pen,
Oh, that's
and then that's especially for first drafts, even first drafts on articles. I've always done it on because I feel like I can't. I want to make sure that I'm not touching a, $1,500 piece of machinery to write. I'm using a dollar pen
yeah.
and then that takes the preciousness out of it.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I'm hurting something. I feel like, oh, this is here's I'm just chewing a piece of gum. I'm not having like, filet mignon on the top of the Eiffel Tower going, geez, I better like this because this is costing
Yeah.
me $500. It's just like, ah, oh,
Yep.
it's nothing.
I agree. And then, and then it goes through a natural revision process then when you start typing it up, because then
Yeah.
you kind of translate it again, and so you add things, you take things away. It's a really good way to do it.
So how did you end up in Michigan? And are you from the mid are you from the Midwest?
I actually am from Michigan.
Okay.
I was born in Saginaw. I lived there till I was 9, then I moved to Grand Rapids, lived there till I was 18, then lived in Kalamazoo. So I don't even know where to say I'm from in Michigan, but and I've lived in Mount Pleasant for a while. But I went to school at Western Michigan University, and then I eventually made my way to a PhD program in Cincinnati. And then if you know the academic life, you can't tell where you're going to end up, because so I applied. I took like 4 years. Every year I was applying, and I kept getting these visiting positions. So I like taught at Miami of Ohio, and then I taught at University of Louisville, and I taught at Kansas State University, and then getting that book published was really what made me a lot more marketable. So I got a few job offers that year, but one of them was here in Michigan, and I snatched it up because I'm from here, and plus the people that work here seemed cool and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, very, very fortunate to end up back in the state where I'm from, honestly.
I mean, I can't wait. My friends moved to Columbus, Ohio, and I'm dying to visit Cincinnati. I'm a huge baseball fan, and I think
Yeah.
Cincinnati Reds have such a great stadium right there.
It
But
is. Yep,
yeah,
I went to
have
a
you
few
been?
games. Yeah, I've been to a few games there. Yeah, it's I love Cincinnati. It's I would have stayed there if I could have.
Yeah.
But yeah, my wife and I really liked it, and both my kids were born there, and it's
Oh,
just
wow.
yeah, it's a cool. It's like a bigger city, but it feels not like a big city. You know what I mean? So it's got
Yeah.
the perks of a bigger city, but it's very easy to get around, and yeah, just a lot of cool things. There's a lot of history there, being kind of the gateway to the North back during slavery times. Slaves would cross the Ohio River there,
Huh.
because Cincinnati was the North,
Yeah.
the edge of the North. So yeah, there's a lot of really cool things there.
Yeah, I want to explore other cities and not just like where I love going to New York. I'm a
Yes.
huge fan of being in New York City.
I love New
Not
York.
money wise. I'm like, oh,
Yeah.
I just walk in and I'm like, I walk right when I get off at JFK, I just take out one of my kidneys and go, will this pay for anything? But yeah, like Columbus, I mean, Ohio's, there's some cool spots I want to visit there. I visited a friend earlier this year. On my way back from Paris, I was like, I want to see Philadelphia. And he lives about a half an hour outside of Philadelphia. By the time I'd been like traveling all over the place, and I took the train down to him, and he's like, so like we're gonna go to a baseball game, right? And I'm like, you have no idea. I don't want to see anything. I've like been on the road for 5 weeks. I'm
Yeah.
right. Is it cool if we just do nothing? And they were kind of like relieved about that. And I'm like, okay, cool. They're like, oh, great. We don't gotta host you. We just hang out. And I'm like, oh, Lord, yes. And we just hung out for like 2 days. And it was, one of the, I'm just like, I know so much about Hatboro, Pennsylvania. I'm just like, I like this place. I could live here.
that's
Just
great.
not is beauty. There's just like beauty around. What is that? A deer? What is this, this weather?
Pennsylvania is a really pretty state, and I like Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh's a really cool town. We've been there a couple times now. It's
Yeah.
yeah, it's got a weird street system. I don't endorse driving there, but it's like crazy to drive there. But
Do they got good public transit where you can get on like a metro or trolleys or
I don't
something?
know. I don't know,
Yeah.
'cause I've only driven there.
Yeah,
But
yeah.
it was wild last time we were there, just how the roads are just they just don't seem to follow any kind of logical pattern. Then you get these ones that are like super steep cobblestone, you know, and then these like four ways, like a four-way stop, but they're, I can't, there's a name for it, but they're like completely separated. We think of a four-way stop as like streets that match up and are right next to each other, but these are like, you know, 30 feet away and it's off center, and then the other intersection is like 30 feet beyond that. You know, that's just like, it's just weird. It's just weird. But like,
Do the drivers get upset with the non-locals for not
oh
knowing
yeah. Oh yeah, of course. No, the first time we were in Pittsburgh, I don't think I've ever seen people flipping the bird as much as I saw that time. I saw somebody flip off a bus for stopping at a bus stop.
Wow.
Oh my
Yeah, that's the
God.
thing I love about it's you never know a city unless you're actually in it and feeling the energy and also feeling the conflict. And also just I love to find out what frustrates the locals like that, like because I can give you a list of frustrations of San Francisco and Los Angeles, and I have my frustrations with some other cities too, but I love learning what the other fr what else frust you know what the minute I get to a city, I want to know what frustrates the locals, so then I can do better myself, and then I can flip off the bus for going to a bus stop, and I'll just be like, hey, what you doing over there?
I totally agree. I tend to try to just kind of absorb whatever the vibe is. But the people are real nice there, but they just, yeah, listen, I'm an angry driver too. You know, I say all sorts of
Oh my God, it's like
I say.
Los Angeles is just Los Angeles. I'm just as I'm going to my car, I'm like, and then just remember that everyone on the road is mentally retarded and they don't know where they're going and they're probably, passing a kidney stone right now, and
There you
you
go.
just got to give them all these excuses for cutting you off.
Okay. And then, man, last time I was in Los Angeles, I ended up getting like, I don't know, at least two tickets in the mail like a couple months later. And I was like, what the hell, man? Like for
Was it
not
what?
complete stop or something like that.
Really?
Near like Mulholland Drive, I think one of them was, or where it was like, you know, they send you a little video of it, like, there
Wow.
was nobody there.
Yeah.
That's kind of
So
annoying.
there's a Los Angeles city thing. So you may have been out of the city of Los Angeles. So what happened, which is, this is what I love to learn. This is exactly when I, because I'm a foreigner in Los Angeles. So in the city of Los Angeles, you can like speed through go through the yellow, then red, and not really, it's just like whatever. And even if there's a camera, they can send you the ticket, but if you don't pay it, that shows that you're not guilty. Like they can't enforce it. But if you pay it, then you've paid it. But the thing is it shifts. Like when you're driving through Los Angeles, all of a sudden you're in West Hollywood, and then that's where. That's no longer Los Angeles, that's West Hollywood, so that's a different city. So you got to be careful and drive a little more careful because those cameras are tagging you. And then
You do have to
you
pay.
get into Beverly Hills, and then once you get right out of Beverly Hills, then you're back in Los Angeles, so you can drive like a maniac.
I see. Yeah, I think one of them might have been near Beverly Hills too. Anyway, yeah, I didn't know about maybe just not paying it. I never thought of that.
Yeah, but yeah, you got to be careful though, because I don't know when that was enacted, but it just for some reason how the laws are written for the city of Los Angeles, and the city of Los Angeles is the one of the weirdest boundaries in the world. I mean, it goes all the way down to Long Beach in this little like string, and then it stops in the middle. It's insane. Speaking of no rhyme or reason, there is a lot of no rhyme or reason in Los Angeles when it comes to infrastructure.
You gotta kind of love it. Love the madness.
Oh, sure.
You have to.
Well, at the same time, I just got back from I was up in at Albertsons in a small neighborhood called Los Feliz in LA, and there's this comedian Jay London who I didn't know he was a comedian. I just went and got coffee up at this place and talked to this guy for a while. And then 10 years ago, Louis C.K. put out one of his specials on HBO. And I'm sitting there with my friend, and the opening act comes out, and I'm like, I have coffee with that guy every day.
Oh, wow.
I was like, oh my God. And then I saw him again. I'm like, dude, I didn't know you were a comedian, which is such an LA thing. Cause you know, they're just like, oh, I didn't know you were a writer. Cause you know, just don't know.
Right.
And,
right.
Anyway, so it was beautiful. Cause I saw him today and, he came up to me and he's like, you know what? I really feel like, I might have ruined our relationship years ago when I asked you for a tranquilizer. I was like, you asked me for a tranquilizer? He's like, oh, you don't remember? And I'm like, no, but now that you say that, that's just like, I don't know what kind of person you are anymore. we're having this like back and forth and I'm like, oh, I like LA today. This is fun.
He
was like, he was on the last Comic Standing. He's been on a bunch of stuff and I just didn't know.
Wow.
And then you just like sit there and shoot the crap with Jay London and Albertsons.
I bet I know who. I used to watch that last Comic Standing. I probably would recognize him.
Yeah, exactly. And he was a fixture at the Comedy Store for years. I don't know if he still does sets there. I don't go to that cafe as much anymore because, well, coffee culture. Let's talk cafe culture. Cafe culture has just gone to hell. And now it's people on Zoom meetings, like just having Zoom meetings in cafes. And I've given up on coffee culture in Los Angeles. And I just go to the park and do my handwriting on a bench. And my people are my squirrels that are just looking at me.
That's kind of sad.
Yeah. And I'm just going, I might have to move to Europe in order to get cafe culture again, or maybe Pittsburgh, but I have a feeling Pittsburgh also has that.
Well, Mount Pleasant, Michigan doesn't. I'll tell you.
Doesn't? Yeah. No. I'm going to be your neighbor soon.
Right. Sounds good.
This is how bad I need cafe culture. It's everything in LA and it's just so rude. It's just like people just on their cell phones on speakerphone and nobody says anything. I'm the one that says something, so I'm the jerk. And then the person will leave and give me a dirty look. And I'm like, look, I'm not getting any applause for this. Come on. None of you stood up for that. We had to listen to her talk in Russian about whatever she was screaming about for like 20 minutes in this like cafe where we're all kind of, you're all on your, you know, writing your screenplays. So you're just in the dark.
That's wild.
Help, get me out of here.
I get it. That would be annoying.
Yeah. If it's like cafe culture is, because it used to be dive bar culture for me, but San Francisco was great for dive bars.
Mm-hmm.
LA, not so much. LA, you go into a dive bar and like the real dive bars, and it's just like, oh my God, I'll just have a glass of milk. And can you, like, do you have any dental floss? Because like nobody has teeth here. So I just.
It's funny that you brought up dive bar in San Francisco because I've been to San Francisco maybe two or three times, but one of the times I went there, I think there was some conference or somewhere. I had a job interview or something like that. But I went out to the bar with this guy that I knew. And it was a very small bar, you know, just like I said, dive bar. And not hardly anybody in there. And there were two big screen TVs on opposite ends of the room. And this one extremely drunk guy was standing in front of one of the TVs, which was playing like a San Francisco 49ers game. And he was obviously drunk. But the timing on the TVs was off, so that the one that he wasn't watching was slightly ahead of the one that he was watching. So I could see what was going to happen. And it was really funny and entertaining. Like, I see that there's like a fumble, and then I wait, you know, 10 seconds, and I was like, oh, you know, and then there's like, you know, a penalty. And so I could watch in real time, and I knew when he was going to get, you know, freaked out and yell at the screen and stuff like that.
That would be so entertaining. Yeah.
It's just really surreal.
Yeah. No, who needs movies when you got a drunk guy in front of a TV screen and then he's on delay?
Yes, exactly. He had no idea that the one just down, you know, on the other side of the room was actually showing stuff beforehand.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
I should have started yelling stuff like before it happened to him, and he would have thought I was some kind of.
I bet you $10 is going to be a fumble in 2 seconds. Yeah. Walking out of there just a big old wad of cash.
Exactly. I should have done that
before he sobers up.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, wait! He turns around and realizes, "Hey, wait a second." You don't remember where? Do you remember where that was? In
Lord, I don't remember. Yeah, it was a long time ago.
There's something. I mean, I was when I couldn't, when I didn't, you know, when I was too young to go to bars, like in the '80s, but in the '90s, I was just more excited to go see live bands in bars. Like that just opened a whole new world to me because you know, I couldn't go see so many of the bands I wanted to see in these small clubs. And then it's just like, all of a sudden I got that, I turned 21 and then I was like 3 to 4 shows a week, probably for 20 years.
Yeah. I was playing in bands, a band then too. So, 89 to like 96. So right in the thick of things.
Those were the sweet years. I was doing college radio at that time. I may have played you.
You may have, yeah.
What was your band?
We were King Tammy. We didn't get a lot of recognition outside of like the Midwest, you know, like just kind of the tri-state area. We didn't tour far or anything like that. But
that's still fun, though. That's fun.
Yeah, our radio station, our campus radio station, would always bring in bands. They had New Music Monday, and you know, like Nirvana played, and like we opened for Everclear. Before they were famous, 311, we opened for them.
Wow.
I think once it got famous, but yeah, it was a weird time. Yeah. Like I remember seeing Nirvana. I actually saw them 2 nights in a row because they played at Club Soda in Kalamazoo. And then the next night, the Flaming Lips were playing in Ann Arbor. And I was a big fan of them. And they Nirvana opened for them. So it was just a weird thing. Yeah. It was before Nirvana was, famous, but
I remember it's, and then there was like Mudhoney would tour a lot in those days. I was always making sure to see them whenever they came through.
They were awesome.
And now the lead singer, Mark Arm, he's the singer for a reunion of the Saints, the surviving members of the Saints. So he's lead singer of that. And Mick Harvey, who's been with Nick, he was new with Nick Cave and the Bad. He started in Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds with Nick Cave and Blixa. He's performing solo in Los Angeles. He's put out a ton of records.
Oh, wow.
And he has never played solo in Los Angeles, like, or anywhere in the United States. He's always been with whoever he's with. He's always on PJ Harvey's tour. He's doing all these other things, but he never does a solo show. He's doing a solo show. He's playing guitar for the Saints, but he's doing a solo show the night before the tour starts in Los Angeles. And it's like, I don't go to shows that much anymore, but I'm at that show. I think it's like next week. I am there. I'm going to be the one fanboy just in the front. And he's opening for someone too. And I'm so excited. I'm like, finally a solo Mick Harvey gig.
Yeah, that'll be great.
Yeah. Cool. The things that move us.
Yes, exactly.
Wait, what do you think got you into writing? What were you reading where you just went, "Oh, yeah, I'm in. This is it."
Well, I mean, it goes back to when I was younger, and probably the first story that really had a powerful effect on me I used to read like fantasy stuff like Piers Anthony and sci-fi, Isaac Asimov and stuff like that, but Ray Bradbury was a big one, but the story To Build a Fire by Jack London was one that really, when I was in seventh grade, it really moved me. And it's I don't know if you remember that story, but it's basically a guy in the Arctic who doesn't listen to the old timers who say that it's too cold to be going out that day to whatever. He's got to get from point A to point B, whatever. And it's a character's not named, it's just the man. And it's his dog. And long story short, spoiler alert, he dies. And
what? Oh my God, I haven't read it.
Well, and so it was just kind of probably the first like kind of existential story that I read where it was, you know, an adventure story, but it also had this real kind of heavy literary feel to it. You know, and then in high school, I really started getting into like the Russian writers, like Dostoevsky, a collection of like short stories by various Russian authors, like Camus and Kafka and Poe, stuff like that. That was really what got me in, you know, as a reader. And then I would write stories, and a friend of mine and I would write stories, and we'd just like exchange them in the hall and just make each other laugh. And you know, I filled up notebooks with these crappy stories that were just wild and just trying to be funny. So I didn't really pursue it seriously until a lot later. I never really wrote what I would consider a serious short story, meaning just even like a complete one, that until I was like 25, you know, honestly. I had dropped out of school playing in a band. I had been out of school for about almost three years. And my wife, who was not my wife at the time, but she was like, you know, you could just go finish up your bachelor's degree and just get an English degree. She knew I had enough credits to get close to that. And I had always liked English classes. So I took a couple creative writing classes, and then everything changed. Like the teachers were like, hey, you know, you could go to grad school for this. And I'd never thought about that, never heard of that. But once I started writing and getting some validation from these teachers, it was just so enjoyable. I just found I really loved to read other people's stuff.
Yeah.
I started working on a literary journal there. And it was just like, and then it kind of coincided with our band kind of coming to an end. And it was a nice way to transition into a kind of art that I was responsible for myself. Like, I'm not putting a dig on any of my band members, but getting five guys to do things, you know, and like, you know, it's tough. It's, you know, it's hard to do stuff as a group. And so this was something I could just control myself and, you know, do at my own pace, whatever I wanted. And so it was kind of enjoyable for that reason.
Yeah, enjoyable and also really vulnerable too, because it's like in the film industry, if you write a screenplay, that's like 200 people that can mess up the film. You can blame it on, you can just be like, oh yeah, if you know, if you have a dud, you're just like, well, you know, it's a shame they didn't do it right. Yeah. And then if it's great, you're going, well, I'm glad they like did my writing right, because that's how that's why it's there. But when you do a novel, you're standing alone, and it's just like, I'm living and dying on this thing. And that's, I kind of like that more.
I do too. I do too. I can't imagine, like, I've made some movies with friends in my time as well. And that also is just like, yeah, just coordinating all that. And like, just the number of cooks with their fingers in the pot, you know,
yeah.
It's surprising that anything gets made, honestly.
it's truly magical. Anything gets made. It's just like, yeah, it's almost like there's it's like the devil's going, yeah, I'll green light that one for some odd reason it gets made.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. The book is called, go ahead. I'm sorry. What?
No. So I still enjoy that anyway. I still enjoy being kind of the one to set my own pace and, you know, sink or swim on my own. Anyway,
yes.
Close that anecdote.
Well, and I think my favorite people are writers and novelists. And it's because we do that. Cause it's not easy. And then people think you get published and it gets easier. And it's just like, no, it gets not easier.
Yep. That's exactly right.
But we still show up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Persistence. You got to persist. That's for sure.
Yeah. So that the only weirdos that I truly understand are people like you.
Right back at you.
Oh, shucks. The book is called The Dark Will End the Dark. It's a collection of short stories. His name is Darren Doyle. Darren, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, it was a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Darren Doyle for coming on the show. Remember, during the holiday break starting December 22nd, I'm doing a screenplay outline workshop. It's a 10-day intensive workshop where on day one, we start with the idea and logline, and through working 2 to 4 hours per day, which includes our Zoom meetings, by day 10, you'll have a detailed 50-scene outline, and you will be able to understand act breaks, character arcs, the hero's journey, and so much more. Link for the registration and calendar is at drinkswithtony.com. I've been lucky enough to put in the hard work and to see my idea turn into a book and then adapt it into a feature film using this formula. It's magical to see. And what was just an idea, it becomes something that hundreds of people work on, and then it finally gets released as a feature film to the public. There's really no feeling like it. I've been teaching for a decade at UCLA Extension, and I want to offer this workshop so that you can see the results during the holiday break. Go to drinkswithtony.com to see our calendar schedule and for those 2 weeks, as well as to sign up. From idea to detailed outline in 2 weeks, you can do it. Hey, thanks for listening to Drinks with Tony, and I'll see you next week. You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.
Les étoiles, dites-moi étoile, pourquoi je vous regarde? Les étoiles, les étoiles, dites-moi étoile qui vous regardera. Volato, lato, rato, lado, lado. Volato, lato, lado, rato, pampitato, lambalado, rado. Les étoiles, si seulement je savais. Dites-moi, étoile, de qui obtenez-vous la lumière? Les étoiles, vous qui êtes belles dans les cieux. Dites-moi, étoile, qui vous donnera l'amour? Volato, lato, rado, lado. Lato, lato, lado, rotam, pam, pidato, lamba, lado, lado. Why I look to you. Volato, lato, rado, fado, rado. Volato, lato, rado, rado, bambidato, lambelado, rado. Les étoiles, les étoiles. Dites-moi, étoile. Je vous regarde.
j'aime voir, chère indolente, de ton corps si beau, comme une étoffe vacillante miroiter la peau. Sur ta chevelure profonde, aux âcres parfums, mer odorante et vagabonde, aux flots bleus et bruns, comme un navire qui s'éveille au vent du matin, mon âme rêveuse appareille pour un ciel lointain. Tes yeux où rien ne se révèle de doux ni d'amère, sont de bijoux froids où se mêle l'or avec le fer. À te voir marcher en cadence, belle d'abandon, on dirait un serpent qui danse au bout d'un bâton. Sous le fardeau de ta paresse, ta tête d'enfant se balance avec la mollesse d'un jeune éléphant. Et ton corps se penche et s'allonge comme un fin vaisseau qui roule bord sur bord et plonge ses vergues dans l'eau. Comme un flot grossi par la fonte des glaciers grondants, quand l'eau de ta bouche remonte au bord de tes dents, je crois boire un vin de bohème amer et vainqueur, un ciel liquide qui parsème d'étoiles mon cœur.
Soleil noir tourne sur la vallée, cheminée muette, portail verrouillé, wagons immobiles, tours abandonnées, plus de flammes oranges dans le ciel mouillé. On dirait la nuit de vieux châteaux forts, bouffés par les ronces, le gel et la mort. Un grand vent glacial fait grincer les dents, monstre de métal qui va dérivant. Je voudrais travailler encore, forger l'acier rouge avec mes mains d'or. Travailler encore, acier rouge et mains d'or. J'ai passé ma vie là, dans ce laminoir. Mes poumons, mon sang et mes colères noires. Horizon barré là, les soleils très rares. Comme une tranchée rouge saignée sur l'espoir. Dirait le soir, les navires de guerre, battus par les vagues, rongés par la mer, tombés sur le flanc, giflés des marées, vaincus par l'argent, les monstres d'acier. J'voudrais travailler encore, forger l'acier rouge avec mes mains d'or. Travailler encore, acier rouge et main d'or. Je peux plus exister là, je peux plus habiter là. Je sers plus à rien, moi, y'a plus rien à faire. Quand je fais plus rien, moi, je coûte moins cher que quand je travaillais, moi, d'après les experts. Je me tuais à produire pour gagner des clous, c'est moi qui délire ou qui deviens fou. Je peux plus exister là, je peux plus habiter là, je sers plus à rien, moi, y a plus rien à faire. Je voudrais travailler encore, forger l'acier rouge avec mes mains d'or. Travailler encore, acier rouge et main d'or. Travailler encore, forger l'acier rouge avec mes mains d'or. Travailler encore, acier rouge et main d'or. Travailler encore, forger l'acier rouge avec mes mains d'or.